Shalom and welcome again to another edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. These podcasts are presented to help explore the impact of the longevity revolution on our congregations and our community. And we invite you to visit our website, jewishsacredaging.com, and the Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page, as well as eliciting your comments to Rabbi Address at jewishsacredaging.com. And it is a pleasure to welcome to the microphone for this edition of Seekers of Meaning, our colleague, Rabbi Phil Cohen.
Hello.
How you doing, Phil?
Okay, I'm doing great. Thanks.
Good, good. We want to talk about Nick Bones and your new book that's about to launch called Nick Bones Underground. And so, first of all, before we get into anything else, who's Nick?
Well, Nick Friedman is he's an aging college professor living in a time when New York City's kind of, well, the world, or at least the United States, has kind of gone belly up. So it's had a negative impact on life in New York City. The subways don't run. There's a very high degree of poverty. Nothing works. And
this is the future or now?
I mean, it takes place about 10 years in the future.
Okay.
creating that reality was a bit of a challenge in terms of whether it was just a complete, in one version, it was a completely alternate reality. And then someone suggested, you know, keep it in the real world, but 10 years in the future. So things have gone topsy-turvy, belly up. But even before that happened, the main character, Nick Friedman, getting kind of old, getting kind of lonely. He's kind of lonely. He's feeling unfulfilled, and decides, based on a piece of advice from a former student, to go into the missing persons business. To go do some missing persons work. So he's a religion professor at an unnamed New York university, and on the side he does very much on the side he does missing persons work. He had one case that gave him some fame. And out of that came a few other cases, but not a whole lot, except when the book opens and he intentionally on the part of the person he encounters the father of his best friend from high school. And that's where the book begins.
Well, as long as you didn't make him a professor, an aging professor of the Hebrew Union College, we're probably in good shape.
I don't know why I never named the university, but I didn't. But it's pretty much supposed to be NYU.
Yeah, well, could be.
I don't really know NYU that well. I didn't want to be naming buildings and classrooms and stuff.
So talk to me about one other thing, because we've had a couple other colleagues on Seekers of Meaning over the last couple of years. The rabbi novelist phenomenon. What is it about it that was this always there? Was this a passion of yours that just finally emerged? Because I know you do some writing and blogging, and now the novel. And why a sort of like a semi science fiction novel?
Well, that's a lot of different questions.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'd always been interested in writing. I made an effort, an aborted one, right after college to get into a Master of Fine Arts program. And when it didn't happen, and I realized how difficult a road it is to become a fiction writer, I moved into other areas and sooner than later into the rabbinate. But I always been interested in creating little stories. And in fact, this book got started in the last year or two of my doctoral work at Brandeis University. An idea occurred to me, and when I got tired of writing my dissertation, which of course was scholarship, I put it aside and play at this. And by the time I was done the dissertation, I'd had about 100 pages written. Put it away, but didn't let it die, I guess. So that many years later, I showed it to a friend of mine who liked it. So I didn't let it, I didn't let it die some more. And along the way, I took a creative writing class in Prescott, Arizona, with a very good novelist named Susan Lang. And I started producing more chapters. And this particular book has been a long time coming, mm-hmm. and very, very sporadically until the last couple of years where I took it really seriously. But that's a longer answer than you were really asking. The idea of creating stories as well as telling stories, which is telling stories, of course, is very much a part of the Jewish tradition, very much a part of, you know, almost every rabbi I know.
Right.
It's something we've always enjoyed doing. So I've got this book, and I've got probably at this point in various places 20 short stories published. I've got a thesis that that was my graduating project for a Master of Fine Arts program at Spalding University. That's a totally different kind of novel, which I'll get to in a few years, because I got to write a sequel to this one first. it's fun, and though it's not easy, I don't get writer's block. I mean, writing is a very difficult process, because you're eternally revising what you've written.
Right.
But I don't sit at my computer and find nothing to write. I'm at least lucky that way.
Well, it's a gift. It's a gift. And so back to Nick Bone's Underground, which is due to be published
November 30th.
So around the corner, and it'll be on Amazon and the usual places, correct?
Amazon, the usual places. And if I come to your town to give a reading, you can also get it in an independent bookstore.
Okay.
Where I hope to come and hope to do a reading there. It's not self-published, so I mean, it will be in bookstores.
So the opening sequence of is fascinating. It's got a lot of texture and nuance. Nick is and very interesting too, that Nick Friedman, like many aging baby boomers, evolves a new practice, a new life vocation, and he's right in the mainstream of many aging Jewish professional baby boomers who leave one type of work and just sort of like fall into and evolve into another type of work. But he's not a religious guy, and he is jogging, which is his prayer. And if you go to in the beginning, I think you said before we went on, you have the book in front of you.
I do.
So he is jogging, which is his form of prayer.
Yeah, not to put too fine a point on it, but he's riding his bike.
Bike, I'm sorry. He's riding his bike, and there's an old man on a bench. And there's that midrash, and don't ask me to give the citation because I can't, about where we could possibly meet the Messiah. Uh-huh. And of course, as you said, this is the opening part of the book that sets the stage. So I'm going to ask you, if you don't mind, we have some time, just on the beginning where it says, on my daily moment of private worship, because I want to come back to that concept.
Sure.
With you. Could you just read that paragraph? I confess.
Sure, happy to. Yeah, I confess I no longer engaged in the act of prayer. I hadn't for some time. In different parts of my life, prayer, both the act of it and contemplation about it, had consumed me. I retained striking memories from my teenage years, which was at a modern Orthodox yeshiva, from my teenage years of smooth-cheeked boys and men wearing long, unruly beards in various stages of graying, all davening, praying with vigor. They would bow up and down, human engines powering a divine machine, eyes closed with orgasmic power, addressing their Father in heaven with words like, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, and when everything comes to an end, he alone will rule, and every soul praises you, O Lord," and so on and so forth, making these and so many more claims of equal or greater absurdity. I mean, no, I prayed no longer, but my act of writing circles around the park day in, day out, replete with dressing rituals, breathing rituals, rituals of movement, rituals of sight and sound, leading to an exertion and sweat, occasionally capped by a meditative mood that, when will and grace combined, would persist for a couple of hours. This formed a kind of religion, at least comprehensible to my colleagues over in anthropology.
So I have to ask you, how much of this is autobiographical?
This doesn't reflect who I am, per se. But it does reflect, first of all, the Orthodox background is not me at all.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm
But you're asking between
between that. The line. Yeah.
I don't think that this is me per se, but there are parts of me, and I can't imagine it's not common among a lot of people, colleagues included, that we have a sort of ambivalence about these things, about the meaning of prayer, the act of prayer, praying regularly, you know, what happens when you pray, and what, you know, what happens when you engage in religious activity. But this doesn't reflect me totally, for sure.
Well, that's the reason why I was asked, because I agree with you. I think that as we get older, especially in the rabbinate, after some of there's a certain amount of change in how we approach prayer. But also, I'm fascinated also by the concept of the ritual, because we do a lot of work with that in Jewish sacred aging. But here you have Nick who's saying, I don't pray that ritual, but I have my own. I have these rituals, which in essence, if you unpack it a little bit, that's his prayer. And you will kind of allude to that in the book. That's his morning, you know, shachrit, getting up, the dressing, the breathing, the thing, the riding.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you said something earlier. That is what I had in mind, at least for this guide, at least for this time in the book. Things change a little bit in the as the book progresses, but he always remains ambivalent. His foil, his computer, is always challenging him about these and other kinds of ideas of his.
Yeah,
but he has the biking, right, constitutes a version of a vision of religion. That's true.
So Shmuley, who is his longtime yeshiva bocher chevra, who he met as a rookie yeshiva student, and they have this wonderful passage where they're meeting for they sit down for lunch, and I think what Nick had a brisket, and Shmuley unpacks the sandwich, which has what in it.
Yeah, it's worse. The kid, Nick has peanut butter and jelly,
right?
And he's feeling it's his first day of school. His parents have made him go to yeshiva, something that's completely out of his framework. And this guy Shmuley, this big guy, sits down and tells him, you know, and tries to, you know, recognizes in him a fellow traveler, but also he, Shmuley, is not as depressed about this as Nick is. And in the midst of that, he reaches into a big bag and he pulls out a ham and cheese sandwich, which he proceeds to eat in the middle of the cafeteria of a yeshiva. And Nick at the time, and certainly in reflection, understands this as an act of rebellion that's so profound that he said the angels in heaven must have gasped or something like that. Yeah.
It's a great scene. And when you sell the movie rights, I was just trying to picture who would play, you know, who. And it has overtones of The Chosen, too. For some reason, when I was reading this book in the yeshiva scene, those old Chaim Potok books, if you remember them.
Sure, of course.
Those images came. So tell me about this sort of like a beginning dystopian society. Lerbs, L-E-R-B-S.
As Shmuley Shimmer, Nick Bowden, Nick Friedman's best friend in high school, starts becoming a more serious high school student by his, senior year of high school. He takes chemistry. It might have been his junior year. I don't remember now. But certainly toward the end of his high school career, discovers that he has a real talent for chemistry. And at the same time, his libido starts really oppressing him, and so in high school he invents, like, it's not nice, it's one of the things that burns Nick down. And I'm not going to tell the whole story now about this, but Nick and Shmuley go to a dance, and without Nick knowing it, Shmuley applies essentially a date rape drug to his date. And it has a terrible consequence, a terrible impact on the girl. She goes into an irreversible coma. Well, later on, as a professional chemist, Shmuley perfects this drug, and it becomes a highly desirable designer drug. It has an impact of simultaneously a very narcotic effect and a very hallucinogenic effect. And the reason it's called Lerbs is because it's in its initial incarnation, manufactured, Shmuley had it wrapped up in like a little colored aluminum foil with a face on it, and it was supposed to look like bunnies, but it looked more like rats, and so it got the nickname Little Rat Babies or Lerbs. The problem with the drug is that if in the reality of the story, anybody who takes a certain number of doses, let's say 30, I don't remember the number, has a better than even chance of going into an irreversible coma. And as society realizes this, the drug becomes illegal, and Shmuley gets arrested, goes off on the witness relocation program, and that's all part of the setup of the book. One of the fun chapters, it was fun writing, and even as I read it now, I still enjoy rereading it, is Nick Friedman gets, in his incarnation, I guess, as Nick Bones, he's investigating the location of Shmuley Shimer. He gets dosed with a triple dose of Lerbs. And the book is told in the first person. So the first person, Nick Friedman, describes what happens to him while he's on this drug. And I think it's pretty funny, but it also has an important development in the plot at the end of this long trip on Lerbs.
You have a variety of different symbolic references in this book. The Velvet Underground, which was not the rock group, but is fascinating because it really is a certain type of reality existing underground.
Right.
And I think you have this line, which is the best of modern civilization lying just below a decaying city. And you could read into that, Phil, a lot more than just part of the plot of Nick Bones Underground. I got to ask you to unpack that a little bit. Is this a sort of like a social comment? Am I digging too deep? Is this kind of a social comment on really where we are in America right now?
Well, partly. Coming up with the name Velvet Underground was just sort of fun. I'm a big Velvet Underground fan.
Obviously.
When one enters the space, you got to enter track 42.
Right, Grand Central Station.
Grand Central Station and go underground. You're met by, among other things, one is met by, among other things, a virtual rock and roll band that becomes very, a lot of different bands. Now, as I was writing it, I'm sorry, what's her name? It just died, the famous soul singer.
You're not talking about Aretha.
Yeah, Aretha Franklin had just died as I was writing. And so the band is Aretha Franklin with a backup at the first time Nick encounters it. In another visit, he meets the real Velvet Underground. So it turns out that the Velvet Underground is not a full utopia, but it is a functioning, it's pictured as a functioning society that does its best to affect justice in ways that don't happen above ground. And in that sense, yeah, it is something of a comment on what's going on in our world right now, in that justice in the world we occupy seems more and more difficult to find. Poverty is increasing, the differential of poor and rich is increasing. I didn't particularly have the current presidential administration in mind, but you could throw that in as well. And so there's a bit of an irony here. I hope works. I think it works. And that is that the Velvet Underground actually has in this book a reputation above ground as being a really terrible place.
Right.
And his computer, who as it turns out, one realizes fairly early in the book, has crossed over and has become human, literally human. Depending on what that means, that's part of the discussion.
We'll get to her in a minute.
And she says, "Don't go down there. You're going to be torn apart." And he goes down there, and it turns out it's a really nice place. And in fact, it's a really nice place in some somewhat surreal moments, but also you know, he walks into a bar and he thinks he's going to get a coffee shop rather, and he thinks he's going to be met by really angry, vicious people, and it turns out, you know, it's a gay coffee shop, and everybody's just sitting around playing games all afternoon, mahjong, and bridge, and poker, and all of that, and it turns out they've got a system of justice, they've got a police station, they've got a hospital, they've got a government, and they try to keep this society a secret from above ground, and because some of their people are heavily educated in high tech, they manage a subterfuge that fools the upstairs for the most part into thinking that what's going on is, you know, is a world filled with mole people, and that you know, you go down, you don't come back up. It's not a terribly complex satire, I don't think, but that's what I had in mind.
So you also channel a lot of what's happening now. I mean, you have driverless Ubers, if I remember right. correctly, and you have Alexa, whose identity in the book is Maggie,
right?
Who is the instead of the human sidekick in many movies, if there was a buddy movie, Nick's sidekick is Maggie,
right.
The humanoid computer channeling Alexa. Because as soon as I read that, I said, my God, I have one sitting over there. How did this idea germinate in your creative mind and find its expression? And the role that Maggie plays, is it the foil? Is it the conscience of the book? What is it?
Well,
or she.
So first of all, it's Alexa, but it's not Alexa.
Well, I know.
This is really a person, and she's one of the things I like about what I've drawn here is that she's struggling herself to understand who she is as a human person. I asked around among some high tech people I know what might happen to create a computer that is far superior to current technology, and they gave me some language which I use in the book, but I'm so uneducated about these things I can't even replicate it now, but you know, this fellow told me certain things have to happen in order for computers to become much, much smarter than they already are. And so this computer is a product of that technological development somewhere in Harvard, sometime at Harvard. Partly where this comes from is that in some sense it's derivative. I mean, all robots or intelligent computer characters in movies and books, you know, owe their origin to, you know, to the early robots in science fiction, to Robbie the Robot in that movie made in the 50s.
To Data. One of my heroes.
The next generation. I don't think I'm just copying that. I'm able to use those ideas and make her curious about her humanness, which Data is. That's very similar. But she's also religious, and she can't understand why Nick is not religious. She can't understand why Nick doesn't see the reality of the transcendent in the same way that she does. So she's constantly ribbing him about that. But she's also constantly helping him. You know, at one point, you know, he asks her to collect, as when he agrees to go hunting for Shmuley Shimmer, as Shmuley's father asks him, getting back to the beginning of the book, he asks her to collect, you know, everything she can about Shmuley Shimmer, and she organizes it, and she creates an executive report, and along the way, she's extremely helpful, and not to give away the ending. She actually saves the day at the end of the book. She's been given some programming, some code that helps her save the day at the very end of the book. So she's a lot of things. And I think the main thing that I'm happy with is that she's very funny. And in that sense, she's the character's foil. She's funny, but she's also philosophical. She's religious. She's smart. She cooks. I mean,
yes, she does.
She makes toast and coffee, and above all, she loves Nick. She, I mean, that's established at the very beginning of the book. She's in love with Nick. And how Nick responds, how that relationship develops is one of the things that evolves and finds its conclusion at the end of the book.
There's a significant amount of Bob Dylan in this book. How come?
Well, because I like Dylan.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, that's pretty clear. That's all. It seemed mostly fun. He plays a surreal role in the book, and it's not clear whether that's really Dylan or just Nick Friedman's imagination. But here's a piece of this. Okay, I don't know if you're going to get to the parody on Haredi religion, ultra orthodox religion.
Well, we'll get to that with the group. Okay.
I'll tell a story, and maybe it can fold into the further conversation.
Well, go ahead.
I knew somebody many years ago who'd become a Chabadnik, and he was living on Eastern Parkway, you know, the main Chabad center. And I asked him, because I'd heard about this. I said, is it true that Dylan comes and studies there? And the guy said, yeah, he comes every now and then, not that often. He comes every now and then, and he studies with us, and we just treat him like one of the guys, you know. And so that's part of where the role that he plays in the pseudo-Chabad, and let me underline, pseudo-Chabad center came from. But it's that the character Nick Friedman, and this is autobiographical, but I mean, what late middle-aged Jewish boy doesn't have Bob Dylan residing in the back of his consciousness? It's either Bob Dylan or the Grateful Dead or both.
Or a hybrid thereof.
Yeah, or hybrid. So I don't know where the original idea came from, but, you know, it fits and it's kind of fun. In the sequel, I think the Bob Dylan role is going to be played by Leonard Cohen.
Well, you kind of like get that hint.
Yeah.
I have to ask you one other thing, because you snuck this in, or maybe you didn't sneak it in, but I'm reading this book and I did a triple take. For those, if there are any colleagues who were of a certain age who studied at the Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, somewhere rolling through about the second, third of the book, pops up Dr. Alvin Reines and his theory of polydoxy. I actually did a triple take on that. What was that about?
No, that's intended for a very rarefied audience.
I mean, I actually said, wait a minute, am I seeing that correctly?
That's for a very rarefied audience. I'll tell you, I asked David Ellenson to write a blurb for the book, and he graciously agreed, and he wrote a very nice blurb. I think I sent it to you, actually.
Right, you did.
And not in his blurb, but in the email preceding it, he said something similar to what you just said. It said it cracked him up. But there aren't too many very inside jokes. That's a very inside
joke. There aren't too many people who are going to get that, really. But just riffing on that section, are there messianic overtones in this book?
Well, I'm not sure how you mean the word messianic. I mean, there's a pseudo messiah. I mean, a good part of the book is taken up with It's kind of a parody on Chabad.
So talk to us. Mention that the group that.
I create a Hasidic group. I call them the Kolbener Hasidim, and for a certain part of my characterization of them, they look a lot like the Hasidim, like the Lubavitchers. The Rebbe is a refugee from Europe, getting away from the Holocaust, escaping the Holocaust, and he sets up a center, and they become very successful doing things that are much like what Chabad does, and much like the life of the last Lubavitcher Rebbe, Menachem Mendel Schneerson. Rumors start flying that he's the Messiah,
right?
And when he dies, his followers still think that he's the Messiah, but that's where the similarity ends. Then some guy steps forward and says, the late Kolbener Rebbe, who's been dead now for 6 months, visited me at my house just before Shabbat, or just as Shabbat began. And it's a little, you know, it's a little stretch of an imagination, but I characterize this group as so prepared for this guy's returning that they believe him. And then they transform into something totally different. They're no longer Haredi, ultra-Orthodox Jews. They're sort of New Agey people that throw out all the mitzvot, which is characteristic in history, especially of Shabbatai Tzvi. When someone claims to be the Messiah, they start abrogating various commandments. So in this case, one of the things that this new group believes in, they abrogate, they give up kashrut, the dietary laws, and they develop a fixation on pork. So instead of chicken for Shabbos dinner, they have pork roast for dinner and so on. But and so the parody continues, but it becomes I think a little funny, but it also becomes a little vicious, as it turns out that this new group, which they call themselves now the Schmelzerites, because the Rebbe's name was Schmelzer, so they're no longer Kolbener but Schmelzer, and they actually, I don't think I'm going to tell this part because it's kind of a surprise in the book, but the messianism of this group is either funny and pathetic, or threatening to become vicious, taking a turn toward totalitarianism, which is another thing I deal with in this book, although only a bit. But the intended satire is both on our gullibility, and not just the Jewish gullibility, but on the gullibility of people to follow charismatic people, even when what they have to say is dopey or bad, or dopey and bad. It's also kind of a reflection on what you might say is the early history of Reform Judaism. Maybe not what Reform Judaism is today, but throwing out kashrut and enjoying non-kosher food, as in the treifa banquet, the non-kosher banquet of the first graduating class of Hebrew Union College in the 1870s, where shellfish was figured prominently in the menu. So it's not just, I'm not just poking fun at Chabad, and I'm not just poking fun at our gullibility, the human gullibility to follow leaders, but there is a poking fun at Reform Judaism in particular as well.
Well, I can see that emerging also. I mean, the cult aspect of the Shmelechites in the sequel, but who knows? Before we run out of time, I just want to follow up, because again, playing around with the text and some of the images that as I read this just popped into my mind, and that is the father-son motif.
Uh-huh.
And because it figures so prominently in the tradition, it figures overwhelmingly in the book of Genesis that we're in right now, and it's here again in Nick Bones, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, part because it's a key moment. It's the key to the whole beginning of the book, and it may be a kind of a key to the end of the book.
It is.
As well.
Oh no, I think it helps tie the beginning and the end together.
That's very nice. You should write a critical essay on this. No. I'll be glad to read it in the journal. But when the father meets Nick Bones while Nick is riding his bike, he says to him, look, my kid's gone away. He's on the witness relocation program. He promised me one communication to let me know that he landed safely, and I never heard from him. I, the father says, I'm dying of cancer, and I want to know if my son is dead or alive. So I want you to find him. So in the end, this is a bit of a spoiler, but as these things go, the character is going to find Shmuley Shimon. I guess that you can take that for granted. And when they find each other, Nick Bones asks Shmuley Shimon, so why didn't you ever contact your father? At first he makes some excuse about how it would be dangerous. And then he says, I just never could. I was too he's done something really terrible. He's done something that he could not ethically possibly recover from. And everybody knows it. That's why he went off on the witness relocation program. And so he says, I just couldn't do it. I was ashamed. Every time I thought to call him, you know, metaphorically or literally picking up the phone, I just couldn't do it because I couldn't face my father. And so the shame of it means they never talk to each other, and they never have that final conversation.
And perhaps he reunites with his own father through his own son. So who knows? But it is a motif again, you know, that it's such a part of our tradition, a great part of our tradition. Rabbi Phil Cohen, author of Nick Bone's Underground, being published right now as of the end of the month of November. Phil, thank you very much for joining us.
I need to say something commercially, if you don't mind.
Well, you have about 30 seconds.
Go to Amazon if you're interested in buying it. Look for it under PhilM.Cohen. Phil M. Cohen. Otherwise, you won't be able to find it.
Really?
Until it starts selling thousands of copies, that's the way you got to find it.
Get that M dot. Okay.
Phil M. Cohen. Well, thank you, Richie. I really appreciate that.
No problem, Phil. Thanks a lot.
And you asked some really good questions. It got me to think about this in ways I hadn't. But thank you very much.
Hey, what can I tell you? It's a rainy Tuesday in Cherry Hill. Or a snowy Tuesday in Cherry Hill. Listen, you can stay well, continue success, stay healthy. I'll talk to you later.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care. Thank all of you for listening to today's edition of Secrets of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. We welcome your comments to me, Rabbi Address at jewishsacredaging.com. And again, please don't forget to visit and like our Facebook page, Jewish Sacred Aging on Facebook. If you go to the website and click on the donate icon, we really appreciate any financial support that you can give to Jewish Sacred Aging. It helps also support these podcasts of Secrets of Meaning. These podcasts are recorded at the studios of Lubetkin Media Companies here in Cherry Hill. We give thanks to our producer, Steve Lubetkin, who will be sharing a word with you in a couple of seconds. Thank all of you for listening. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address, and I look forward to greeting you on our next Secrets of Meaning. Shalom.
Turn your podcasting passion into profits. The book, The Business of Podcasting, describes the business side of podcasting, including how to become a professional podcaster. You'll learn about positioning your clients' expertise through podcasting, too, plus the best business models, how to find clients, and much more. Visit thebusinessofpodcasting.com.